hppodcraft.com.
The thing on the torture rack began to moan. There was a grating sound as the lever stretched the iron bed still one more space in length. The moaning grew to a piercing shriek of utter agony. "Ah," said Dr. Stugach. "We have him at last." He bent over the tortured man in the iron grill and smiled tenderly into the anguished face. His eyes, tinged with delicate amusement, took in every detail of the body before him. The swollen legs raw and angry from the embrace of the fiery boot. The lacerated back and shoulders, still crimson from the kiss of the lash. The bloody, mangled remnants of a chest crushed by the caress of the spiked coffin. With gentle solicitude, he surveyed the finishing touches applied by the rack itself. The dislocated shoulders and twisted torso, the crushed and broken fingers, and the dangling tendons in the lower limbs. Then he turned his attention to the old man's tormented countenance once again. He laughed softly in a voice like the tinkling of a bell. Then he spoke. "Well, Hassan, I do not think you'll prove stubborn any longer in the face of such eloquent persuasion. Come now, tell me where I can find this idol of which you speak."
That is the very visceral opening of Robert Bloch's story, The Faceless God. It utilizes elements of the mythos created by H.P. Lovecraft, who was also a mentor to young Bloch, and that's why we're covering it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. And the reader we just heard there was Jason Lee, whom we heard a long time ago on The Diary of Alonzo Typer.
A long time ago.
I don't even remember what that story was about, but Jason's back, and he's known for lots of anime titles and video games. He's also a stand-up comedian. I, of course, know him as a friend.
You know, this story was first published in May of 1936 of Weird Tales magazine.
I know that, yeah.
And Robert Bloch was 19 years old.
Yeah, that's pretty young to be knocking out something this, I don't know, that's pretty evil and sophisticated. It's got kind of a Tales from the Crypt, like, revenge motif.
It does. But that's sophisticated for a 19-year-old.
I mean, when I was that age, I was writing plays about disco zombies. This is a little more heady than that.
Hey, man, disco zombies may be out of fashion, but you were writing about disco zombies in the early 90s.
That's true.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit.
People weren't sick of disco zombies yet.
No.
One thing I learned about Robert Bloch while I was doing some of this research, he was a bit of a comedian and a performer. He wrote comedy sketches. And,
what?
And during the Depression, he did campaign management. I mean, this guy was a jack of all trades in terms of his writing. But around the same time as this story, 1936, he sold gags to radio comedians Stupnagel and Budd, as well as to Roy Atwell. Stupnagel and Budd.
I don't know who those are.
I don't either, but they were pretty famous. They were radio's earliest satirists. Budd was a musician, Wilbur Budd Hulick, and then Stupnagel, which was a nickname that he'd given this other guy. Colonel Stupnagel was the character. It was a former lumberman. Frederick Chase Taylor was Stupnagel. He was the great-grandson of British-born Aaron Lovecraft of Rochester, New York, which makes Taylor the first cousin of H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, my God.
So Stupnagel was Lovecraft's first cousin, and Bloch wrote some material, or some gags, rather, for their program. So,
whoa.
It's an insignificant world, but it is still a small one.
Yeah, that's really weird and esoteric.
Yeah, it just kind of flipped around that way when I was looking it up. There's a trailer for a movie that I saw somebody post. It's called How to Plan a Movie Murder from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You can look it up. It's a trailer, and it's got Robert Bloch in it.
Oh, as an actor?
As well, it's basically they're talking about how they're going to plan a movie murder. It's William Castle, you know, that kind of B-movie director.
Yeah.
Joan Crawford, famous for her childcare, and Robert Bloch all hanging out in a living room talking about planning a movie murder. So if you just want to see Bloch hanging out and talking.
Wait, is he playing himself?
Yeah.
Ah, I see, because they're like, well, let's get the guy who did Psycho.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, it's that kind of, you know, when they used to do movie trailers that didn't really show you anything from the movie, just like Hitchcock would come out and talk about birds or whatever. It's that tradition of things. So I'll put it up. It's kind of interesting. But this story, obviously not a comedy.
It starts off with a torture scene, which is pretty grim. There's this Dr. Stugach, who is a bad guy, and he's torturing this guy, Hassan, until he doesn't even look human.
Yeah.
He's so mangled and screwed up his body that he just looks like this thing. Since he's a doctor, I guess he's a medical doctor. We're not sure about that. That he's able to keep him alive.
And he's trying to get information from him about where this idol can be found. So very... He's an Indiana Jones villain. A little rougher, even. This Hassan, he finally gives up the information. He whispers it into Dr. Stugacz's ear. The evil doctor gets one of the native guys to put an end to the man's misery. He gets a sword, cuts him down. It's a really awful opening. And of course, the doctor walks out of... It's in like a cellar torture chamber.
Yeah.
And as the doctor walks out, he starts to whistle to himself and he's laughing and he's very pleased about what's just happened. He's that evil.
So I guess it's in a chapter two.
We get some more information about what's actually going on. Some background on this doctor who, again, it says he's got some knowledge of anatomy, so I guess he's a medical doctor.
But he was also an archaeologist.
Yeah.
So was he a doctor of archaeology? I don't know, man. He doesn't seem like the kind of guy that would really get his PhD, you know?
He'd come to Egypt many years before. He was on the staff of this archaeological expedition, but he was dismissed, and people say he was trying to steal trophies from the expedition. From there, he disappeared for a few years, but then he came back to Cairo as a quote-unquote adventurer, basically smuggler. He's smuggling goods. He's, you know, he's not the kind of cool Han Solo smuggler, because I think he also smuggles people.
Yeah.
And also black goods, whatever those are.
Well, I thought maybe it was black market goods, but it also might be some kind of slave trade.
I think it's both. He's about 45. He cuts a fat figure. You know, it says his piggish eyes were filled with greed. His fleshy mouth was lustful. His only natural smile was one of avarice. So his body, his face reveals his character, his internal character.
It also has the detail that he's got skinny legs, mm-hmm. which for some reason I love because I don't know, maybe it's the cartoonist in me, but I think he would be a fun guy to draw.
Oh, right. That makes him spider-like as well.
The thing is, this doctor, he is not superstitious. He doesn't fall for people's BS stories
right.
because people are always talking about buried treasure and lost pyramids and all that stuff. He likes solid things, shipping opium, rugs, and human beings.
Oh.
But he does believe that this particular story that he heard about this idol is true.
He thinks that this has something to it. Well, here's the reason. The story is there were these nomads who were on this secret journey. They were smuggling some stuff
mm-hmm.
across the desert. So they weren't traveling normal trade routes. They were on some untrodden land. And they come across this strange rock or stone. It's something old that had been buried for who knows how long, but because of shifting sands has now become slightly uncovered.
Right.
When they get closer, they see that the thing projecting from the sand was the head of a statue, an ancient Egyptian statue, with the triple crown of a god. Its black body was still submerged, but the head seemed to be in perfect preservation. Kind of odd. It's been buried in the sand for so long. The smugglers don't recognize it, but it definitely gives them the creeps. I think the workers, who are native, have bad feelings about it.
Right.
They decide they're going to mark the spot where they saw it with these two huge rocks. Maybe not even so they can find it again, maybe just so they can avoid it.
Right.
And the workers mutter prayers when they're doing this. They don't say why, but it's clearly disturbing to them. So when they get back to the north, they tell their story around town. It says, as most tales were in the habit of doing, it came to the ears of Dr. Stugacz. Or Stugacz, I assume it's Stugacz.
Kunfache, actually, I think is his name.
Yes, Kunfache.
The doctor thinks that this is worth finding because they're not saying that it's treasure out there, but that it's an idol. And he's like, oh, these stupid Arab smugglers, they don't even know what they found. Now, if they were saying it was a big gold thing,
yeah.
they would have taken it. But they don't realize its value.
Lots of wild clues like this have led to the biggest discoveries in Egyptology up to that
exactly.
point. Even though he's got a pretty good business going, it reveals his character a little bit. And probably related to him getting booted from that expedition that we heard about, that he still kind of wants to be respected as well.
Yeah.
Granted, if he made a big discovery of some new idol out in the desert, it could also make him rich and famous, but rich and famous as an archaeologist.
Yeah, he's really keen on showing up the people that kicked him out of the archaeological dig.
Right.
And, you know, that's a common villain theme. You know, they laughed at me and I'll show them, mm-hmm. which is strange because I feel like the underdog should be the hero and not necessarily the villain.
Yeah, well, and also the afflicted party become a villain because the reason they got booted anyway or they're not respected is usually because they take shortcuts. They didn't earn it.
Right.
So they think, I'm going against the mainstream and that's why they don't like me. But no, it's because you're messing with things you shouldn't, or at least you're not getting other people on board. You're not writing those peer-reviewed studies.
No. He's not doing lab testing. He's experimenting on people that he's captured.
But this being an old story, you know, a lot of these kinds of things are still, a minute ago we were not laughing at it, but the fact that he is probably shipping humans back and forth, that's still going on.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And then talking about these monuments out in the Middle East right now, how ISIS is just destroying them because they're false idols or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I know ISIS hasn't gotten far enough into Egypt to be able to, but they've called for the destruction of the Sphinx and the pyramids. In Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, they've destroyed so many artifacts. There were those 1,500-year-old Buddhas in Afghanistan that they exploded. You get pretty inured to the constant fighting in the Middle East and the terrible news that comes in about another bombing. But for some reason, whenever I hear about these artifacts, because they're so much larger and longer than any single human could be.
Yeah.
They represent so much. And they represent this really rich cultural history of the Middle East. And to hear that these idiots are just blowing them up, it makes me so angry.
I'm glad that you're talking about this on the podcast so that our ISIS listeners can really think about what it is that they're doing. The doc didn't want anybody to scoop him on this idol thing, so he had his thugs grab this old camel driver who had been with the Arabs that had saw it. Mm-hmm. That guy, obviously knowing something about the statue being, you know, bad juju, didn't want to talk about it.
But that's the person he was torturing in the beginning, was this camel driver.
Right.
Who, you know, you think would give it up immediately, but is still reticent even after all that torture, just because he knows how bad this thing is.
Yeah.
Once he's got that information, he's ready to start 2 days later. Hires a small number of natives. He doesn't want a bunch of people to come with him because he doesn't want to excite undue investigation. He gives out to his business acquaintances that he's about to embark on a special trip, but he won't say what it is. He also hires a strange dragoman.
Yeah, that's a half man, half dragon.
That's what I thought, but I looked it up and it's not. It's a translator.
Now I have to reimagine this story. I was really bummed out because he didn't breathe fire or nothing the whole story. I was like, why are they bothering with the dragon man?
I know. He just kept frowning about things happening. He didn't fly or nothing. Well,
that gets us to chapter 3.
Right. Based on this info they've got from the tortured and now dead native, they're out there on this expedition. On the morning of the fourth day, they arrive at the location where the stones are. Even though it's the middle of the day, it's crazy hot. They've been taking a long trip. Everybody's exhausted. The doctor's like, okay, guys, set up camp. And when they're done doing that, all right, gives them no break. Get over there, move those stones, and clear everything away.
Just really driving home that this guy is bad. He's a bad person.
He's a bad doctor. He's a bad archaeologist. And he's just a bad employer. No coffee breaks. Doesn't give people reviews in a timely fashion. Eats people's lunch out of the fridge. Just doesn't give a crap. So the guys go out there. They dig this thing up.
In a few moments, there was a loud cry from the gang of laborers as a black and sinister head came into view. It was a triple crown blasphemy. Great spiky cones adorned the top of the ebony diadem, and beneath them were hidden intricately executed designs. He bent down and examined them. They were monstrous, both in subject and in execution. He saw the writhing worm-like shapes of primal monsters and headless slimy creatures from the stars. There were bloated beasts in the robes of men, and ancient Egyptian gods in hideous combat with squirming demons from the gulf. Some of the designs were foul beyond description, and others hinted of unclean terrors that were old when the world was young. But all were evil, and Stugach, cold and callous though he was, could not gaze at them without feeling a horror that ate at his brain.
The natives are like, oh, hell no. Once they get a view of this, they're talking among themselves, and the doctor hears once or twice some vague references to the name Nyarlathotep and a few allusions to the demon messenger.
We have some disagreements on the pronunciation of this.
Yeah, I don't know if I used to say Nyarlathotep.
Yeah, Nyarlathotep, Nyarlathotep, whatever.
Well, the doctor's like, all right, you bitches, get over there, start digging this thing out. I want to put it on the, you know, they're refusing to do it. They're going, no, this is a bad idea, because they know they have an idea, however they pronounce it, of what this is.
Nyarlathotep is one of Lovecraft's most used gods. I mean, he's in a ton of his stories. The first story, of course, is Nyarlathotep, which is the one where he's kind of the showman that shows up and does the whole electrical, you know, we covered it on the show.
We did. Obviously.
We covered all of these on the show. But he also appears in Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, but he's an Egyptian pharaoh. He's in the Dreams in the Witch House. He is the black man that hangs out with, you know, the witch. Mm-hmm. He's mentioned in Rats of the Walls as a faceless god in the caverns of Earth's center. And then also he's in Haunter in the Dark. He's in with the crazy rantings at the end of that story where he says, is it not an avatar of Nyarlathotep who in antique and shadowy Chem even took the form of a man? He has all these different forms. And that's one of the things that people latch onto when they write other stories about Nyarlathotep. He's made out to be more like a messenger of the outer gods. Like he's the one, because they're all just crazy. All the, you know, Abhoth and Azathoth and all that stuff and Yog-Sothoth. They're just, we can't conceive of them. They're way beyond us. Whereas Nyarlathotep, for some reason, has dealings with humanity and uses humanity and like, you know, he makes himself a god and he's worshipped, and like why he does those things, nobody knows, but he seems to have a vested interest in humans specifically, whereas most of the other gods don't.
He's kind of like the Silver Surfer as well, right? Like,
he kind of is.
If the Silver Surfer shows up, then Galactus is not far behind.
Yeah.
Right? To eat your world. And I think that it's the same kind of deal here. It says what the natives are thinking, or what they're whispering to each other. It was bad business to incur the wrath of the old god, the secret one. But perhaps he had not heard of Nyarlathotep. He was the oldest god of all Egypt, of all the world. He was the god of resurrection and the black messenger of Carneter. There was a legend that one day he would arise and bring the old and dead to life. So that kind of thing I was talking about. I tried to look up Carneter. It's some kind of Egyptian underworld, I guess, but I didn't find...
All I found it was in a book called A History of Art in Ancient Egypt, and it just had this footnote of a guy saying all the festivals of Carneter. Now, is Carneter a place? Is it a god?
So yeah, I couldn't figure out what it was. But Stu Gotch is getting mad about all the superstitious nonsense. So he does what any reasonable person would do. He pulls out two Colt 32 revolvers.
Says,
I'm tired of being nice to you guys. I'll take the blame from the monsters, the ghosts, or whatever. I'm not afraid of a stone idol. Get over there and dig that SOB out. Now, those are some pretty good persuaders, the guns.
Yeah. It says the natives seemed properly impressed both by the revolvers and by his fluent profanity.
When he called them SOBs, that's what got them. Oh, come on, man. That really hurts. Fine.
My mom's a really nice lady.
Yeah, that's not fair. This is kind of how The Exorcist kicks off. Not with anybody holding natives at gunpoint, but when they find that statue of Pazuzu in northern Iraq, that means that bad stuff's coming. So after a few hours, the crew get the idol dug out. It's totally preserved, the whole thing. Not a scratch.
Yeah.
It's horrific. It says Stugach saw it now as it must have looked when it was first buried, and the sight was not good to see.
It resembled a miniature sphinx. A life-size sphinx with the wings of a vulture and the body of a hyena. There were talons and claws, and upon the squatting bestial body rested a massive anthropomorphic head bearing the ominous triple crown, whose dread designs had so singularly excited the natives. But the worst and by far the most hideous feature was the lack of a face upon the ghastly thing. It was a faceless god, the winged faceless god of ancient myth, Nyarlathotep, mighty messenger, stalker amongst the stars, and lord of the desert.
Now, this guy must be a bit of an ornithologist as well, because he's able to decipher those wings as being vulture wings and not any other kind of bird. I couldn't, if it's a stone sculpture of wings, I couldn't tell an eagle's wings from a vulture's wings or any other bird. If you put them on the back of a hyena.
Yeah, but if they were little like penguin flippers, you'd know that.
Well, that's a little different. But vulture wings, come on.
The natives of Egypt, they know that Nyarlathotep is the master of evil.
Yeah.
Doctor doesn't give a roar about that. He's like, this thing is so sweet, it's going to make me the biggest Egyptologist. This is older than anybody else's crap.
Yeah.
There are things that he doesn't know that get explained here. And I don't know if these are just being whispered about among the natives or if somebody's actually telling him this. All references to Nyarlathotep have been wiped out over some time. Now, some other gods like Thoth, Set, Bubastis, and Sebek got pieces of his character. Even the devil got pieces of his character in Christian mythology, sure. But he's the original main guy.
Right, yeah.
He's the ruler of the underworld. Mm-hmm. Says it was he who became the patron of sorcery and the black arts. Once he alone had ruled and men knew him in all lands under many names. They did not care for the gruesome sacrifice the dark god demanded, nor the way his priests ruled. And at last, the cult was suppressed. But Nyarlathotep had come out of the desert, according to the legend, and to the desert he now returned. So, like other gods in this mythology, he seems to be asleep, waiting for something to happen. But there are still cults for this god.
Time passed. This is pre-history when all this stuff happened, because it mentions that in his exile, Atlantis fell.
Right.
So that gives you an idea how long ago supposedly this happened. New people overran the land, but the desert folk remained. They viewed the building of the pyramids with amused and cynical eyes. Wait, they counseled. When the day arrived at last, Nyarlathotep would come out of the desert and then woe upon Egypt.
He's the first guy that's going to happen. Nyarlathotep's going to rise. He's the harbinger of all the other mythos stuff. One thing I thought was cool is it said the stars would move. Not that the stars going through their natural rhythms would suddenly be right and that would bring all this about, but that when it happens, the stars themselves would shift to become right, which is a new kind of concept to me. And it talks about how the old lands and the creatures will rise out of the sea and all that stuff will happen if he comes out of the desert again.
You know, there are a lot of accounts of more recent pharaohs trying to erase previous pharaohs from history. In fact, they were pretty successful a lot of the time because we have very limited knowledge about some of those rulers.
Well, I would guess that there are some Machiavellian reasons for it, like perhaps to hide lineage.
Yeah.
So that you can preserve your right to being pharaoh or to the throne.
Right, right.
But the idea that because they did such awful, unspeakable things, that that's why they're being wiped out, that's great. And this says, in the medieval times, the story and its prophecy were carried across Europe by returning crusaders. Thus, the mighty messenger became the black man of the witch covens.
There you go.
That came out of the Middle East when the crusaders were coming back. That's cool. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And his name is mentioned cryptically in the Necronomicon, of course.
Yeah.
But even Alhazred had heard it whispered in tales of shadowed Irem, but he still doesn't have all the facts because of all this erasing that happened. By word of mouth, his tale has come down through the ages, and there are those who still wait for the day.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about it, is that the cult still exists, or these people that know of him and still talk about him. And, well, actually, not the cult. Lots of people know. These people that are working on the site, they know about it, and they fear it. They don't worship him.
When they first saw the headdress, they were scared, but after they saw the face, they became frantic with dread. Because the face, there's nothing on it. It's blank.
It's faceless.
Once they've seen that, they've pretty much made up their mind to get out of there. Actually, he's the one that's a complete idiot here, because he's like, they'll be fine. Superstitious idiots. He just stands there thinking about how awesome he is and how stupid these people are. There was a great, he says, silly, all Egyptian myths were stupid. Statues with animal heads suddenly coming to life, reincarnations of men and gods, foolish kings building pyramids for mummies. Well, a lot of fools believed it. Not only the natives either. Whether they believed it or not, they were going to move his idol, damn them, even if he had to shoot them down to make them obey.
Yep.
So he eats a big meal, goes to bed early, knowing that he'll get all these idiots to help him out in the morning. And I think his plan is to haul this thing out and get it back to Cairo by boat.
Chapter 4 gets us into him waking up several hours later. It's morning. He has a nice little stretch, splashes the water on his face, feeling good. Everything's great. He goes outside. Maybe the guys have started work already, you know, getting it moved. Opens up his tent flap and the camp is completely deserted.
They've taken all the food. All the camels and beasts of burden are gone. No water. He's got nothing.
And immediately he realizes, oh no, I'm screwed. I'm 4 days into the desert. And with no water, no food, there's nothing.
Just like there are no atheists in foxholes, there is nobody lost in the desert who doesn't suddenly believe in Nyarlathotep. That's what goes on here. I mean, he's like, I don't want to believe all this rubbish, but man, maybe this is some kind of supernatural revenge. Which I think is what's cool about the story, because actually it's not.
No.
Those guys were just like, he's a real mean employer.
Yeah.
He's messing with things that he shouldn't, so let's just abandon him. It's actually a pretty good way to deal with it. And the story is really just a lot of wind-up to watch this guy get punished, which, boy, he does.
Yeah, it's a lot of punishment. First, he thinks, well, maybe I could, there was an oasis to the north, but I don't know which way is north. Oh, wait a minute. The statue was facing north. I remember one of the guys said that. So he goes over to where the statue is, and guess what? It's completely buried again.
Right. He has that moment where he goes, I've got it all figured out. Oh, no. Because they did do some work in the morning. They didn't want to leave that statue out. So they filled it all in again. Actually, even put the two original stones back up on top.
Yeah, which are too big for him to move on his own, because he tries to move them, but to no effect.
So he had that chance to know where north was. Now he doesn't know. And it's the vast, unchanging desert. He doesn't know which way to go. There are clouds in the sky that are covering the stars, so he can't use them as a guide either. There's no cell service out there, so no Google Maps.
Well, his plan is to wake up when the sun comes up, and then he'll know at least which way is east, and then he'll be able to figure out north from that, and then go. But he ends up sleeping too late until the sun is too high in the sky, so he doesn't really know which way things are. And we just, you know, one bad thing after another. So he just is going to make a run for it, basically.
Yeah, he just picks a direction at random, and he's just going to go, 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 go. That gets you into chapter 5. And it's what's great is long before he had planned, his bloated body had given way beneath the grueling strain. His tired legs buckled under him, and he collapsed upon the sand. He was thinking, I'll go while it's still cool in the early morning, and then I'll sleep during the middle of the day when it's terribly hot, and then try and move again at night. But he falls asleep right in the hottest part of the day. He's running over a burning plain in his dreams, unable to stop, while searing pain eats into his charred and blackened feet. And then his legs actually get eaten away into ashy stumps, and then the desert becomes this lake of living flame into which he sinks. He raises his head before his brain boils out of his head, and he sees the Dark One. Nyarlathotep.
As he looked, he seemed to see something in that black pit of horror. Something that was staring at him from illimitable gulfs beyond. Something with great flaming eyes that bored into his being with a fury greater than the fires that were consuming him. It told him wordlessly that his doom was sealed. Then came a burst of white-hot oblivion, and he sank into the seething sands, the blood bubbling in his veins. But the indescribable horror of that glimpse remained, and the last thing he remembered was the sight of that dreadful empty countenance and the nameless fear behind it. Then he awoke.
So when he looks into Nyarlathotep's blank face, he does see something.
Kind of the indescribable, horrible thing that are in a lot of these stories.
I mean, he's being tortured just as severely as he tortured at the beginning. That's really the message of the story, I suppose. He keeps going in the sun. He's dying of thirst. He's dying in the heat. This is after he's woken up. And he starts to have this feeling that the thing is right behind him.
He just starts to run, and all of his plans are gone. And, you know, he thinks he was moving in one direction, but he realizes that he wasn't, because he's back at where his tent was and where his camp was and where the stones are.
He ran in a big circle and spent a lot of time doing it. Now he's back at his own camp.
Yeah.
Completely wrecked. And he's feeling that this shadow is pursuing him and pursuing him and pursuing him. He's thinking over and over about the word Nyarlathotep. And he's even thinking about back when he tortured that guy. The guy said, the mighty messenger always claims his own, a black man with a staff of serpents. He cometh from out of the desert across the burning sands and stalketh his prey throughout the land of his domain. We don't know if this is a hallucination or if it's actually happening. As he gets back to the camp and he's all exhausted and he thinks the shadow's behind him, there's a tremor in the earth, right?
It pushes the sand up and then it rolls over on him.
The idol comes back up out of the ground. And the shadow that's chasing him seems to merge with the idol. And it's like he's falling towards it, being submerged in the sand. It was this dream come true, for behind that mask of stone, he saw a face with the eyes of yellow madness. And in those eyes, he read death. So even in the statue's face, he can see that horror that he dreamt about. And then he sinks into the sand with the idol, and there's nothing left except his head that twists around on the ground and struggles to free its imprisoned body. So it's that horrible thing, buried in the sand with only his head sticking out.
When morning came, Sugach was still alive, and the sun baked his brain into a hell of crimson agony. But not for long. The vultures winged across the desert plain and descended upon him, almost as if supernaturally summoned. Somewhere, buried in the sands below, an ancient idol lay, and upon its featureless countenance there was the faintest hint of a monstrous hidden smile. For even as Stugach the Unbeliever died, his mangled lips paid whispered homage to Nyarlathotep, Lord of the Desert.
Now it's the end of the story.
It's very sadistic. Just set, you know, an evil guy up and let's make him suffer. But I also kind of like those stories.
But what's the point of these kind of stories? You know, like, this is very, like you said at the top of the show, Tales from the Crypt, bad person gets punished. When I'm reading this, I actually feel bad for the guy. I can't help but feel empathic towards him, even though he's a horrible person. And I know he deserves it, but I still feel like this pity.
Yeah.
But am I supposed to read this and go like, ha ha, you jerk, that's what you get. Eat it, nerd.
I think so. Well, it's kind of like, there's a classic Tales from the Crypt where it's a guy who runs a school for the blind, and he's really mean to all the blind students. And at night he can hear all these like power tools downstairs and stuff, and then eventually they lock him up in this pitch black maze in the basement of the school, and there's razor blades on the walls.
Oh my god.
And ravening dogs in the dark that haven't been fed. And so he's trying to feel his way through the maze and cutting himself open, and then these dogs are chasing him. It's the same kind of thing where it imparts a sort of glee because somebody who was awful gets their comeuppance. But that little bit of empathy you feel, I think, is instructive too. I mean, isn't it kind of more trying to impart, you know, don't be cruel to people? You are supposed to share in their punishment a little bit.
You think that's it? Like that there is some bit of evil within all of us. And as the reader, you can relate on some level to this person. As bad as they are, they're still a person. And that you've done bad things and it's supposed to make you look at yourself and the bad things that you've done and be careful not to do those bad things again.
I think it's a mix of those things, yeah.
I'm not a fan of revenge tales.
Really?
Because to me, I just feel bad afterwards. After the whole thing, it's like, I wish the person wasn't bad to begin with, and I wish those bad things didn't happen to him.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a softie when it comes to that sort of stuff. I mean, this story is very well written. I am quickly learning that Robert Bloch was a very, very good writer.
Yeah. Well, but you know, the revenge tales often don't end with the hero very... Now, this is different because it's just a kind of crime and punishment thing. But in a lot of revenge tales where it's the hero of the story, a Count of Monte Cristo kind of thing.
Right.
They often end the story very unsatisfied and very unhappy because in the end, revenge isn't much of a reward. So there's that element of it too, right?
Yeah, I think those are slightly different stories than this.
Like a Batman.
Yeah, well, those stories I can get on board with, but it's just this kind of, it's almost torture porn type of stories I just don't really care much for.
Yeah.
Anyway, so next week we're going to skip because there are 5 Thursdays in October. So we're going to just skip this week because Chad and I are actually going to be in Chicago around this time and we are pre-recording this.
We'll be in Chicago doing our live show, which will be more Robert Block stories. So don't worry, more is coming, but we are taking 1 week off.
The next show that we're going to do is called The Opener of the Way, which is, of course, another Lovecraftian story. Robert Block wrote a lot of Lovecraftian stories.
He sure did.
Using the mythos. I have a whole collection of Robert Block mythos stories called, I think it is The Opener of the Way.
We should say that because these aren't for free online, as far as I can tell.
No, I had to buy this one as a PDF, but it is available as a PDF and it's not much. You know. So if you like these stories, I recommend picking them up because he's good.
Yeah, we'll link out to where you can pick that book up.
I want to thank our reader.
Yes, Jason Lee, thank you once again for coming back to the show. We're so glad to have him.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com. hppodcraft.com.